Hey everybody, it's Jim Mallard here. Welcome to the Mallard Report. The Mallard Report is recorded in front of a live virtual audience on the Duck Pond. Tuesday nights, 9 p.m. Eastern, live. Mallard.com. M-A-L-L-I-A-R-D.com. One more thing before we start. Let me turn it over to my friend that you may know from Ancient Aliens and The Curse of Oak Island and many other things, Robert Clotworthy.
On the Mallard Report, the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed on the show are solely those of the hosts and guests and not necessarily of Evergreen Podcasts, KillerPodcast.com, sponsor or affiliate, or any other individual or group. On the Mallard Report, the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in the show are solely those of the hosts and guests and not necessarily of Evergreen Podcasts, KillerPodcast.com, sponsor or affiliate, or any other individual or group.
So I want to welcome everybody in this evening. Sorry for a slight delay. Well, of course, if you're listening to it via podcast, you have no idea what we're talking about. So a little housekeeping before we begin. I've shifted everything over to YouTube because, well, it's easier that way. I've had a long conversation that I'll spare some of the details of because I want to get to the night show, but basically it boils down to why pay for something when somebody else is giving it to you for free, so we're going to use the YouTube chat instead of my own chat. Fair enough. Okay, my guest tonight is Dr. David Perodin, the author of Velocity of Information, School of Errors, one of the leading school safety experts in the nation. David, how are you doing tonight?
Yeah, Jim, I'm doing great. You know, technology is a crazy thing, isn't it? But I am thrilled to be back on the Mallard Report. Love the Mallard Report. Love everybody in the Duck Pond. And boy, there is so much going on in the world of school safety. Right. So, yeah, it is. It is definitely very busy times.
So let's jump right into it. Because we talked the other night. I don't remember which. Maybe it was Tuesday even. I don't know. My days have all blurred together like you wouldn't believe. And we wanted to talk about AI because that's kind of been the driving force over the last couple of weeks. And the first thing that came to my mind was, hey, I'll just write my essay for your Mr. Perodin's class with ChatGPT, and you know we'll just call it good. What do you think?
Yeah, you know, that's completely possible. And I think AI is going to curate information. Information will become clearer, but it's going to dampen new information. But with that said, right, if I had an assignment where, you know, Jim, you were supposed to write the history, the biography of George Washington, right? If you were to do that, you would be hunting through encyclopedias, doing online searches and things like that. I think AI is going to have this liberating effect and the ability to just pull a lot of that information forward. And you're not going to have, the student isn't going to be taking time in something where it's just a hunt for information. So does this impact the integrity of information? So I checked with the university that I instruct for. They're confident that their plagiarism tools will detect if papers were generated through AI devices, software, right? So I guess we'll see. But yeah, I mean, I think this is already proven that it's been able to do qualifying exams and things like that for students. So yeah, we are in a world, right, if you have an assignment which is just harvesting information that likely could be done by AI, whether or not it would be detected by some type of plagiarism detector, you know, likely now, yes, there would be enough that it would match it, but in the future, maybe not.
I was going to say, there's such a fine line there between plagiarism detection and general, I mean, I don't know. We're all taught to write the same way. David, help me out here. Turn it down a little bit. I mean, right? Like,
right. Right. So I think I think where we're headed with AI very rapidly is what do we have to know, right? When I was growing up, Jim, I remember in fifth grade having to memorize the capitals of all 50 states, and it didn't make a lot of sense to do that. Because, right, you look that up and it was just information. It wasn't practical. So I think AI is going to handle a lot of this practical information stuff, right? It's going to liberate us from that. Now, the question, I'm trying to figure out, what does this look like in a school setting? And I don't know the answer to that, but I think what's going to happen very fast is schools are going to have to determine what is important? Is it working with AI? Is it banning AI, right? You're going to have these big movements that are going to happen very rapidly. I will tell you, I think you have to embrace AI right off the bat. If you're a school, how do you work with these different AI programs that are curating information for students? And I'm kind of perplexed. I listened to an interview that Elon Musk gave within the last week, where he was saying, you know, we're closer on the path of singularity than what we think, you know, maybe 10, 15 years away. So what is the information? What are we having to teach people? Is it the asking of questions? I don't know. I'm a little bit lost myself right here.
Well, I've sent out my daily reminder. Well, not my daily reminder. Obviously, I do the show on Tuesday. My Tuesday reminder today was Bill Murray with the 1+1 memorize, with him being the quote-unquote teacher. And I think we're past those days of having to memorize a whole bunch of information.
I agree with you. And that's not the way schools are set up, right? So they're set up with a level of memorization. Calculators. Yeah, my dad talks about stories back in the 1960s, you know, when a calculator was banned from school. I mean, you could, you know, if it was contraband, you couldn't have that. And now it's ubiquitous, right? We all have calculators on our phones and on our devices. So I think what's going to happen, too, is with AI, is it going to cite sources? So if AI is helping you to generate a paper, is it going to go back and go to those root sources and those citations? And if not, that's going to show up in plagiarism checkers. Like if it's just pulling information and it's already cited somewhere. So I think there's this whole thing of providence too, of like, where does the information start that might be rooted out a little more from AI? School boards don't know how to handle this right now. Should they ban AI? Should they embrace AI? They don't know where to go with it.
Well, I mean, like you said, they should embrace it, but how do we embrace it? Because, I mean, we're talking about throwing out hundreds of years of standard technology. I mean, not technology, but teaching, I guess, is what I was looking for.
Right. Yeah. So these become, Jim, I mean, huge industry changing. If we think of education as an industry, right, or field, right, well, field changing things, right? How do we, you know, you look at a curriculum and how do you decide what to instruct and how to interface with AI, right? I think that is the question of how do you interface with AI, and I don't think anybody's quite. No one's on the cutting edge of that. No one is leading that wave of how do you have a lesson where part of the lesson is that you're going to go to ChatGPT or you're going to use this other, you know, these other AI, whatever emerges. I don't have an answer for that, which seems really crazy, like to be on, right? But I've been talking with school administrators. I just finished a class of 15 new school administrators that they don't know where to start with this. They are hesitant, right? Do we accept AI, a teacher proposing that part of a student can use AI to augment their research? There's nothing with board policy. Is that cheating or is it using the available resources? So that's the thing. And there's really little guidance out there. Yeah, I had 15 students and nobody could give me a position on that. What they would do if a teacher came to them and said, I want to use AI in this lesson next week.
So perfect segue, because we're talking about changing textbooks and all this other stuff. You wrote The Velocity of Information, which I believe came out on audiobook yesterday, right? Or is that today?
Yeah, a couple days ago.
It was today then. Perfect.
So it depends, right, where the distributor, right? The Velocity of Information is now on audiobook, Human Thinking During Chaotic Times. So velocity is speed in a direction, and information is coming to us. It's blasted out faster than ever. So, you know, we're just saturated with information, but it's more than that, right, Jim? It is information that goes directly to us because the algorithms know the content that we've searched over the past 10 or 15 years. It knows our location, our GPS location. And that information suddenly that was just thrown out at everybody, that happens. And then, you know, within minutes, information is coming directly to us, curated to our site, to our interest, to our bias, to, you know, previous purchases that we've made. So this is something that is pretty, it's pretty unrivaled, right? To have this amount of information. There's something called a wet bulb effect, wet bulb. So let me explain actually what a wet bulb is. So on a humid day, you have two thermometers, and you take one and you put a muslin cloth over it that's damp, and you're running air, like a fan over it, and then you have another just regular thermometer next to it. You're not doing anything. The temperature between those two thermometers, so a wet bulb, if it's blowing and it's evaporating, it's sucking heat, one of the thermometers should be lower. So, right. So then if you're outside, you'd feel comfortable because it's not very humid outside. Now, if you are blowing air over this thermometer, nothing is evaporating because the air is already fully saturated, you'd feel humid and it would be uncomfortable. And that's where we're at right now with information in our environment. There's so much information out there and you can't escape it anywhere. So people are inundated through their phones, on TV, through billboards, through the conversation that other people are having, right? The conversations, because it's kind of media centric. So it is really burning out people. And in the book, I talked about this concept of finite voltage. At 90 days in chaos, people burn out. And, you know, we've seen that through the pandemic. And I think it now continues through inflation, through the war with Ukraine. We're in this state of chaos, kind of this orbit of chaos. And we've been there for about 3 years. And I think it's a very frightening kind of scenario for us. So one of the things I wrote about in The Velocity of Information is, so we all have markers in our lives to pass time. So those could be holidays, right? So St. Patrick's Day, 4th of July, Halloween, right? We're passing through time. What happened in 2021 is the holidays kind of blended together. So people didn't take down their Christmas trees. You could go on Amazon, you could go on Etsy in March and find St. Patrick decorations for Christmas trees. You could go in July and find 4th of July decorations for Christmas trees because people weren't taking the trees down. So we've kind of we've kind of mashed everything together over the last few years, and we're not transitioning crisply anymore. And I think, you know, you and I talked about it, Jim, even the advertising industry of back to school or other things, I mean, it's kind of, those aren't in line anymore. It's kind of like everything is just mushed together. Is that your perception?
Yeah, I was gonna say, because I know, like I said, I told you back on July 1st, I was noticing back to school stuff. And now you're seeing holiday stuff on sale before the holiday, which blows my mind.
Yeah, it is. You're right. And, you know, with the velocity of information, the way that we look at the world, you know, changed, right? Everybody woke up in March of 2020 and we were deemed essential or non-essential. So you're told to stay home, or you're told to go to work, right? Or this is going to be remote, this is going to be in person. So, wow, now every decision people make, right? Their decision making, their speed of decision making, there has to be something that's brought in there of, well, what happens if I am deemed essential or non-essential again? Here's an example. In Seattle, people who were deemed non-essential, right, told to work from home, they might live in a 40, 50 story high rise. So I talked with a realtor out there and she said, you know, that became very difficult for people to manage because you can only have one person in an elevator at a time because of social distancing. So you'd have this long social distance line of people waiting to get up to their apartment, you know, after going to the store and pretty soon. So like, you know, do you want to live in a downtown area where it's going to take you 20 minutes to get up to your apartment, and also where the buses might shut down or they might limit, you know, to 5 people on a bus or something like that. So, you know, in careers, right? If you're going to choose a career, are you going to live in the city? Are you going to live in the country? I talked to a dentist, and at the onset of the pandemic, you know, the first few weeks said, I don't know what's going to happen, right? Because there's no guidance and I'm shut down. And so, you know, would you be a dentist again, knowing, you know, essential, non-essential. So this whole speed of information and the types of decisions we're having to make have drastically changed in the last 36 months.
Yeah, it's fascinating to think about all the different changes and difference in reality. Okay, Shifting Gears brought to you by evergreenpodcast.com. Shifting Gears brought to you by evergreenpodcast.com. Now, this is where we got fun the other night. We started talking about deep fakes, and I've been watching a lot of these on the internet.
Yeah.
Like President Trump saying all sorts of, I mean, anyways, or Biden or any number of politicians, right? I mean, so they're already circulating out there saying whatever they want to say, but if it gets into your local school with your local teacher saying something that may not be true or may not be horrible, yikes. What? Okay, so we were saying we don't have policies for AI earlier. I can't imagine your local scoreboard has even wanted to think about this yet.
You're absolutely right. So of the, you know, roughly 50 students, for example, again, these are aspiring or new administrators that I've worked with in the last year in my classes. They do not have policies for deep fakes in school. And so let's run through something that actually happened last month. It was March 8th. Vice News did an article. There were 3 high school students just north of New York City. They posted videos on TikTok that appeared to show a nearby middle school principal and a member of law enforcement making violent and racist remarks. The videos were determined to be deep fakes, and they were created by students at Carmel High School, right? But there was they had to do a lot of interviewing. There was a lot that went into that. But, you know, it doesn't take much right now to go in with an app or to hire somebody, you know, for $20 or $50. But this was, okay, this in New York, this was high school students who were able to create these deepfakes from existing video that was online. And again, you know, software that can take a voice sample and make it pretty close to, you know, an output file that would be pretty close to that person's voice. So schools they're not even thinking about this, but they have to, because this again is a tsunami. You can look and see that this is going to hit. So the questions come up, right, Jim, of what do you do if a staff member, a student says, here, I have a video, and it's a staff member saying,
the Maurer report sucks.
Right. Right. And so the staff, you know, the staff member is brought in by administration, or even like the video gets submitted, you know, anonymously, and they're saying, hey, like, you know, what's the deal? We've got this video here. And what administration probably would do right now is they would default, and they would put that person on administrative leave while they investigate it, as they would for any other claim of harassment or bullying or inappropriate conduct by that staff member. They would put that staff member on leave while they investigate. It might be paid leave, but still, right? So so this person, what are they going to say? I didn't say that, but then, you'd be, well, here's the video that you are saying it, or you know, you are making this, the, you know, demonstrating these behaviors, right? The motions or whatever it is. So I think that's terrifying, right? Like, how do you, first, what is the process for a board of education? Are they going to put somebody on a paid leave? I don't know. How would they investigate this? I mean, nobody has school staff trained to look at this and to determine if the video itself has been manipulated. You go to the police department, you're going to be waiting in line, right? Because they don't have the resources and the people to do this, especially once this starts to roll, once this is happening, you know, almost daily or more, multiple times a day. So yeah, Board of Education policy needs to address this. And, you know, this is where we go back into what is authentic. And I think it's really interesting, Jim. Back in, what was it? The General Grant at City Point. So there's a famous picture, General Grant at City Point, General Ulysses S. Grant. But it was a photo montage. That was back in the 1850s. So you can look up General Grant at City Point. And so it was pretty common, actually, back in, you know, the 1800s with early photography to create these quote unquote retouched, or what we call today like photoshopped images, where it's either a collage or some, you know, things are edited out. And I mean, you could pay to like have your deceased relative like in, you know, next to you in a picture, you know, like a double exposure type thing. But some of these photos are in the Library of Congress and they're considered to be authentic narratives. You know, they're not with a little line underneath saying, by the way, this is retouched and we don't know what the original ever looked like. So, Jim, I mean, think about it. You know, you're watching TV and they're like, here's the new phone, and you take a picture and then you can click in these three things and erase these two people and this car in back, right? So in an instant, you can change the authentic record. So that is also terrifying, and it's terrifying. You know, it's marketed, it's ubiquitous. We're just used to it right now. So what is authentic? And schools are going to have to answer that question. I mean, we could have a liar's dividend here. So you have, you know, a star athlete on another team that you're going to play, right? You put out a deep fake video and that athlete is, you know, suspended or unable to play for 48 hours as that video is being investigated. And I think, Jim, what's going to happen, this is going to give rise very quickly to an entire industry that is going to investigate deepfakes. You know, school safety is a $3 billion industry. And when we think of school safety, we're thinking of harm, school shootings, violence. I think what is going to happen, vendors are going to come to school and they'll say, listen, upload this video to our AI software program, right? And we will determine if it is a deep fake. But, you know, if we can't determine for sure, we'll put you in a confidence zone. We're 80% sure our software that this is a deep fake. So then as a Board of Education, you have to decide what you do. Is 80% mean then that person, you know, you consider this to be authentic? Well, what about the 20% chance that it's, or you know, a deep fake? And so it is so crazy. And it was June of 2019, Congress held their first, I talked about this on PBS a couple of years ago. Congress in June of 2019 held their first hearing devoted primarily to the threat of artificially generated imagery. So, you know, we are so far behind on this. It is absolutely terrifying. Unless you don't,
I'm sure you've seen the clips from the TikTok hearing the other day, and I'm sure you're just terrified about technology as I am at this point. Does this connect to your Wi-Fi? I don't know.
I don't know. You know, so Jim, I think where this takes us with schools is a really interesting intersection. And that's, how do you get the authentic record of what happened in a classroom, right? So, you know, again, a video surfaces or something, or how do you get the authentic record or the providence, the actual starting line? And, you know, schools typically don't record what happens in classrooms. They record hallways, right? But they're, or outside of school, but they're not recording classrooms. Part of that also is, you know, teachers are teaching a curriculum that the school is paid for. So it's proprietary. That curriculum can't be be, you know, relayed publicly back out because it's proprietary information. But, you know, what's going to happen? Is it going to take, you know, a flurry of 10 teachers in one school in 1 week to be the target or the recipient of deepfakes or even, you know, administration? And they're going to go to the school board and say, we need an authentic record. Or in other words, teachers are going to be wearing body cameras, or there'll be a static camera in more settings, including the classroom, that's going to create that authentic recording that they'll be able to go back to during the investigation. As crazy as it sounds, I think what is going to drive body cams in school and video in classrooms isn't anything to do with guns, isn't anything to do with threats of violence. It's going to be deepfakes. And I think it's going to be the integrity of the teaching profession, teachers saying, I can't take this risk, right? I can't be in here and not have this authentic record that's happening, you know, at this while I'm teaching, right? So that's something I never thought about until the last year. And I thought, yeah, you know, this is probably going to happen. We are probably going to run into Board of Education policies and cameras in schools, and it's not going to cameras in classrooms or cameras on teachers. It's not going to be because of violence. It's not going to be because of active shooters. It's going to be because of deepfakes and just protecting and establishing an authentic record.
Yeah, as I say, it's wild because we've been having these conversations about school safety for, 4 years now or so, and I never thought we'd be here.
I never. You know, again, I've studied this, right? And I wrote School of Errors. I never expected that we would be traveling down this road. I'll tell you though, the moment this hit me was when I was watching a Major League Baseball game. So it was in the summer of 2020. It was Fox, and so the stadiums were closed, right? With the pandemic. So you had, like, you know, the cardboard cutouts in the stands or just nobody in the players would be playing. And Fox showed that they could put fans in the stands, digital avatars in the stands, digital humans. And they could, you know, okay, here it's 70% Milwaukee Brewer fans. Here it's 70% Cub fans. Here they're doing the wave. Here they're, you know, changing their clothes and they're just pressing buttons. And I'm looking at that thinking, oh my goodness, like, that's terrifying because that could, you know, that could be changing the density of people at a political event. So it looks like it was highly attended when it wasn't. It could, if there was a protest, lines in front of a grocery. I mean, all these things could be manipulated with that same technology that obviously would get cheaper and more ubiquitous in more people's hands. So yeah, that's when I started to think, how are we going to get this authentic record? And then I started to see that, you know, I just shared with the principal or that school administrator in New York. And there are more and more situations like that are popping up on the internet. One was a high school cheerleader who was accused of vaping, and she was temporarily taken off of the cheerleading team. And her mom said she did not vape. This video has been altered, right? It's been deepfaked, and it turned out that it was deepfaked. But yet this cheerleader lost time on the team because of that. So yeah, this is terrifying. And it's one of those things where I think the people that are cognizant of it, they don't want to, there's a massive amount of work that would have to come into how are you going to address that? So, you know, there's kind of this pause, right? Is a state going to jump in? Is this going to be some software program that each state will buy or the federal government would buy? And then schools could upload these videos. And then it kind of gets really weird too, right, Jim? Because then the AI of the videos gets better at detecting deep fakes, but then it's a circle because then the deep fakes get better.
I was going to say, so, is the AI good enough to detect the fakes in the first place?
That is exactly the question. And so where I live here in Wisconsin, we have 421 school districts. And if they're left to their own devices, you know, they're going to, just like school safety, there isn't inter-rater reliability. Each does it on their own. So you're going to have school districts that have all kinds of different programs, or maybe some where it'll be just an administrator or a team of three people that will look at a video and they'll try to identify. Or you'll see some guide that'll come out and say, look for this. You know, maybe there's some fuzziness around the ears on a deepfake. It'll be all this crazy stuff, right? So, but nobody is on this. Nobody has a Board of Education policy, and you could shut down public education with this in a month if this was coordinated. Look at what swatting has done. And Jim, recently it was discovered that swatting is when numerous school buildings or school districts in a state, there's a call that there's an active shooter in the school. So in our state, I think on one day there was like 20 or 30 swatting, and it's not the calls, right, come in, but these are not authentic events. But you have to have the full police response. And so, but you could with these deep fakes, right. And you could definitely have this erosion in the trust of the public institution of education. And it doesn't stop there, right. It could be, it could go anywhere. I mean, it could be the postal service. I mean, it could be companies, you know, Amazon drivers and things like that. I mean, and where does this stop? So, but just looking from the school side, I see this being able to significantly alter schools in a matter of months.
If not, I mean, it could just happen at any point. We could be predicting it happening this week, next week. I mean, we could be on the edge of this, and you could say you heard it here first. Okay.
You could say, you could say that, Jim. And the other part is, what if this is already built into a program, right? Because I lost track a little bit when I was talking about swatting. The swatting came back and it was found to be in a program that somebody developed. And somebody, you know, kind of like a dark web type thing, right, was paid $50 and they created a program to randomly select districts and send out this AI generated voice, which would be, you know, pretty close. And you know, there's a shooter in the school, right? So what if this is out there as a virus, or what if this kind of gets in the system? So it's not centralized, it's actually cloud-based, and it hits at a certain time. So what if the AI is just out there scanning like this show, or it's scanning, you know, random school classroom, you know, presentations or feeds, and it's just taking that in. So this is a thing where I think, as I talked about these deep fakes in schools, you think it's going to be students who attend that school are going to be the ones recording and doing the deepfakes. It might actually be decentralized. It might be this deepfake is created, you know, on the other side of the world, right? And then is sent forward to the school. So that is the part that I think is even more terrifying, is how do you investigate this when you don't know where it originated?
So I got a question. Well, I got a couple questions here from Germantown Runner. So we'll try to get them, but I want to get this first one first, because this is a good one. Elon Musk said we should pump the brakes. Oh, I forgot the big air quotes. Excuse me. Pump the brakes. There are the big air quotes. On AI until we can collectively get our heads around the ramifications of this technology. What do you think?
I heard that interview, right? And I agree, but I think the reality is it's not going to happen. It simply isn't going to happen. I believe it was in that same interview in Germantown Runner, could maybe confirm on this, where Elon Musk said, you know, regulation, the car industry is heavily regulated. So all the stuff to build a Tesla that you have to go through and that you have to send a rocket up. But yet, you know, there are more satellites being put up every day through the world, you know, countries or entrepreneurs or businesses in Mexico, Central America, just send these things up. It sounds good to say that, right? And it probably is the right thing, but how can you do that? And also, it's not centralized, right? You can't look at one, you know, what was it? Kind of in the movie, like Terminator, right? Terminator 2, you can get to like where the center is of the data center. And I don't think it is that way. Everything is cloud-based, so it's replicated on different computers. So, you know, I understand the pump the brakes. I think that made sense 10 years ago or 5 years ago. Now I think it's just, so in the archive, right, it looks like you tried to close the door, but the horse is already out, right? Because I don't believe.
Yeah, you're far too late in the process when I've used ChatGPT. Like,
no, you are. No, you are. So that's the thing, right? I think the reality, if we're going to be completely honest, is this is way further down the road than what the public realizes, right? And I'll go back to, I think this was fascinating. So Michaela Sosa, S-A-U-S-O, Michaela Sosa, in 2016, Michaela Sosa hit the scene. And she was like a 19-year-old from L.A. and had several million Instagram followers. And everybody was like, Michaela Sosa, right? You know, just and she was interacting with other people. Here's the thing. Michaela Sosa, in 2016, she was an avatar. She was created, right? There is no human Michaela Sosa. But they, the team, I guess, I don't know what they call themselves. It was just some wacky name, dreamers or creative, whatever. So they made it, you know, they created this whole backstory, and they put it out on social media, you know, like her high school yearbook photo and the clubs that she was in and all this stuff. She modeled clothing for Calvin Klein, and nobody knew this until about 2019, 2020, they came out and said, yeah, she's actually an avatar. Levi's, Jim, last week, Levi Strauss said, we are going to be using digital avatars to model our clothes. Not that they said that exclusively, but they did say it. So you had a number of actors and also people from the acting profession were coming out and saying, So are you like eliminating our jobs and you're creating artificial authenticity because you are creating avatars that are representing different cultures or ethnicities? And I mean, it's really weird. So,
it gets weirder than that, right? Because then we could avatar Elvis and.
You could avatar Elvis, you could avatar, you know, a person with a disability, right? So instead of having an authentic actor in a wheelchair, like someone who is wheelchair bound, you could just digitally create a avatar that you're using for marketing that uses a wheelchair. So this is, I think we go back to the Michaela Sosa, which was really fascinating when I presented on PBS about that. You know, we're looking now, that's 7 years ago. And the technology at that point crossed what's called the uncanny valley. So usually you could look like in the Polar Express, like that's a good movie. Polar Express came out like what, about 20 years ago, Tom Hanks and the animated kid going to the North Pole doesn't believe in Santa. But there were a lot of reactions from kids where it felt weird. It was cringy, right? Because the avatars, the creation wasn't quite there. So there's this term called the uncanny valley. I forget. It was a Japanese professor that came up with that term, I think in the 70s, saying, you know, you'd always be able to tell if something was a digital avatar or kind of a deep fake. It would always have this feel to it. You'd be able to pick it out. You can't do that anymore. So that is something we know we're past the uncanny valley. You know, when I was watching that Elon Musk interview, he was pretty scared. I mean, you could tell he was nervous about where things are going to go with, I think, the use of deepfakes. And again, you know, Jim, remember back 15 years ago, the commercials, and it was LifeLock. Here's my social security number on the side of my car or on my garage door, right? And, you know, subscribe to LifeLock. Now, I don't know anything about the LifeLock product, but I think you are going to see very soon something of your insurance company is going to market this rider if you are the victim of a deep fake, right? To damage your reputation, or you're going to see this on TV. You're going to start seeing commercials. Hey, you know, have you been deep faked and it's hurt your reputation? Call this number or subscribe to this service and we'll be scanning and, you know, or we'll give you up to $50,000 in, you know, research and support. So I see this as the insurance industry, right?
Well, even is if going they can't do anything, it does take your money and run.
I think people are going to be so panicked and they're just going to scramble at this. So if you put this out there, if this was a TV commercial tonight, right? If this is after the 10 o'clock news and it's like, you know, you don't want to be the victim of a deep fake, or, you know, if you are, like, what are you going to do?
See the scary commercial right now.
I can see the commercial too. And you will have people who will jump at that. And that's where I think the vendors are going to come into this. And I don't want to, you know, some of the vendors will try to authentically try their best to remedy this, and others will just be in it because the fear, right? And they can exploit this. But this has spun in a direction where I didn't expect to be talking about this. I didn't expect to bring it into, you know, a course syllabus. But again, if I was asked what the number one threat to schools was or is right now, I would say deepfakes. Hands down, it's deepfakes.
So I want you to run that scenario by me that you run at the end of your classes, because I ran it by a bunch of people that I've talked to in the course of the last week, and I just want to see the pawn's reaction to it.
Are you talking about the drone?
Yep.
Okay. Yeah. So here's a scenario that I run past my students, and they can only answer yes or no. You can't give any conditions. Yes, but
everybody got that. Yes or no.
You have to answer yes or no. You can't have any riders, any stipulations. So here's the scenario. You have a rural elementary school, and let's say a second grade student has wandered from the playground into a wooded area in back of the school. And suddenly, you know, you realize the student is missing. The recess aide tells, you know, the office, and as the administrator, they tell you, we have a student missing. All right. So you say, all right, call 911, and you gather some teachers and you go out and you start to figure out how you're going to break up and look for the student. As you're out there, there's a man who runs over to the school carrying a, you know, like luggage, right? And
hopefully he's dressed more like you than me. But
and he says, who's the principal over here? And you're like, I'm the principal. Okay, I can help you. What are you talking about? I have a scanner. I have a police scanner. I heard the call for the lost student. I have a drone. I can get this drone in the air. It has camera, infrared, all the, you know, the heat sink. I can get this 30 seconds and help you look. And then we stop right there. And I say, what do you do? Do you accept the drone, that this person is going to contribute this drone and help in this rescue? Or do you say no? What do you do? So again, you have an index card and you have to write, yes, I would accept the drone, or no, I would decline, you know, the offer of the drone. And you don't put your name on it. And again, you can't do anything else. So I guess I won't say how that comes out, but how about people in the pond? I mean, what would they do?
So where can people find the velocity of information? Will they give, because of the lag time between live and our conversation?
Oh yeah. So, the velocity of information, right, is on, it's places that sell books. So you can get it off of Amazon. The audio book, will be on Amazon. It's a little bit later. It's on Barnes and Noble right now. So you'd have to search around. But the audio book is out there on Spotify, and, so it's available in Kindle, paperback, and audiobooks. So whatever works for you. Kindle has an awesome version because there's a lot of graphics in the book and photos that you can work with in Kindle. But the audiobook was narrated by Ben Hawke, who's an actor. He did a phenomenal job and it's priced really reasonable. I think the early release price is $8.99, and it goes up a couple dollars after that. So it's a really great listen. 12 interviews. So you're getting, you know, Larry Lawton, America's biggest jewel thief. You're listening to Linda Stone, who talked about attention and how our attention there's this continuous partial attention. It's just amazing stuff. So yeah, the velocity of information, and it's all over the world, which is really cool. The book is, you know, in the United Arab Emirates, in Germany, in China. It's showing up in libraries and universities. So I've really been happy with how people have been receptive to the book. And I think it's a terrific document of the year 2020. It's not solely about 2020, but I have 471 endnotes. Again, a lot of images. You know, remember when we all had the alerts coming on our phones saying, hey, you know, your governor is going to be on TV tonight. Like, I have screenshots of those that are in the book, and things that people might have forgotten, you know, like your essential papers to travel, you know, and that's brought up in the book. So, and again, it's this thing of, if you get a network, Jim, so there's a big part of the book on member check network. If you get five people together and you have them check, what's happening at the store? You know, where was it? Is it cashless now where you're at, you know, in Pennsylvania versus Wisconsin, and what was in stock, what wasn't in stock? Tell me what's happening. Are the hospitals delaying procedures, you know, right now? So what is happening? Are they closed down the parks? Do they take the hoops down at the local park? Is your, you know, state park closed? So those types of things are a quick way to find out authentically what is happening versus what the news is telling you, because the news is just, you know, replicating from one, you know, one station to another, to another, to another. So how to build that network. And if you get five people together, you can get pretty accurate information with just five people.
So I'm surprised, David, of the three people that answered, all three of them said yes. So I'm going to say no. I'm going to say no, so you can answer for me why we should say no.
Okay. Well, first of all, I think you should say yes, but why you would say no. So when I run this in class, it is almost a 50-50 split. So the people who say no, they say it's not in our policy. We've never practiced for this. If this person is streaming this because, right, they're aware that video can be live streamed, what if, you know, they are live streaming this and this rescue turns out poorly for us, you know, or this effort. But they're really lacking discretion, right? They feel... they'll say yes, but I have to get approval, right? Yes, but I have to call my superintendent, or yes, but I have to take this person's ID and run it through our background check thing to see if they're a registered offender, right? So they'll say stuff like, yes, you can't do that. So people are very afraid of getting in trouble, even though when we break this down and we have this discussion deeper, most will say, yeah, it's a resource, we should use it if we can possibly, you know, find this kid. But they get really scared because, you know, how you can be portrayed by the media. And administration turns over in schools. The superintendents last 2 years. So maybe, you know, that person you don't know very well. You're not sure the Board of Education has your back. You don't know how the media is going to portray this. So, and then, you know, I have a scenario. Well, what happens if this person contributed the drone and they help locate the child, but a day later you find out that person is, you know, also a convicted felon, right? So then how does that change things? You know, does it change things, or should it change things, right? So these are the kinds of questions. So if you're thinking that's where schools are at, and now think of deepfakes, right? So it is a huge gap. But yeah, who has professional discretion? Who has professional discretion? And then is the Board of Education going to have your back?
Question that Germantown remembered me to ask you about. Oh, hold on, let me get it here so I can ask it correctly. Not what I'm going to ask you. Should school boards be nonpartisan or have candidates allied with a political party?
Oh, that's a good question. That's a really good question. I think school boards should be nonpartisan. But that's changing. You are clearly seeing school boards which are becoming partisan, and people are running campaigns I've never seen before. So you're running for a position that might pay you $3,000 a year, and you're running a $10,000 campaign, right?
I'm not good at math. Doesn't make sense.
But I think you know, to these people, you're seeing these school board campaigns really going to a different level, and city council type things, where you're, and right, the backing of different groups behind candidates is very clear in some of these races. And that was never the case, or it was very seldom the case, even 5 years ago. So yeah, it's very different now. I don't think it should be partisan, but it seems like that is much more frequently observed today.
As we tap around the issues, it should be the children first. It shouldn't matter. But anyways, we'll tap right back out of that conversation, because I know there's a lot of sticky widgets for either of us on that conversation. But let's go back to AI and in the classroom, because now we've got our camera mounted up there so we can get the realistic authentic account, is what you called it earlier, right?
Right, right.
Now could I throw some AI monitoring software on there so I can monitor my kids and maybe find the next, maybe not necessarily school shooter, but some, but you know, cause I've mentioned the pool AI that I sent it to you, or maybe you've seen it.
Well, you did.
Yeah.
Someone who,
you know, needs help.
Right. So someone who, so what you're talking about, right, is AI, and like lifeguards could use, it could be set up. And if someone is drowning and they have certain flailing motion that is associated with drowning, it identifies that motion, or,
yeah,
you know,
can
in
recognize
a pool
facial features now for somebody who's depressed.
Right. So that software exists. And I think there's a lot of good with that software. And I've had vendors who have demonstrated some of this software to me, right? If you're making a motion, and it's not just detecting a weapon, but if you're making a motion to try to hit somebody, or if you had a knife or something like this, there's certain pattern motions that go with those. I mean, and we're talking of thousands and thousands and thousands of videos, and then, you know, identifying the motions that precede the behavior. So the question is, could AI be built into that same camera that's in the classroom? Yeah, it could be. There'd be vendors who could do that tomorrow that I know who could do that. Now, is it, how effective is that? You know, that would be very much in its infancy. But again, it's hard to, you know, when I wrote School of Errors, when I talked about school safety in 2013, I cautioned people about vendors, but we've seen a lot of failure in just personnel responses, right? To investigate threats, law enforcement responses have been questionable in some very high profile school shootings. So, you know, I think this becomes more appealing to school boards, but you're right. I can envision school boards agreeing to that if that proposal is out there. And some of them are doing it right now.
Say, it won't be long. But as Sarah the Wood Duck just pointed out, well, now I'm getting in trouble for something I fakely did because I'm trying to get out of class.
Yeah, right? No, Jim, that's a great question, though, because so what if it does happen, right? So what if it detects that? Then you're going to have to go back to the authentic image, right? And you're going to have a human look at that and say, no, that was feigning the movement. I mean, it could be like someone who's faking drowning, right? And then the AI activates the thing. So right, you're always going to have this kind of give and take, this battle back and forth of, once the system's there, people figure out how to work around the system, and then there'll be adjustments to the system, then there'll be workarounds. But right there is a perfect scenario. And I would love to see that at a conference in schools. Nobody presents on that. But that is, wow. You know, and the other thing, Jim, we talked about was, who vets this stuff? Who tells you that this works? And there's something called shadow vetting. It's a term that I came up with, shadow vetting. And I think you look at the district next to you.
So lay it out here so we can get it out there.
Yeah, you look at the school district next to you and it's like, well, they bought this expensive, you know, AI system and all of this. They must have done their research, right? So, and we trust them, so we'll just accept it here. But then you don't know if they really did the research. You're not doing your research. Maybe they thought the same thing. Here's a district that must have done the research. And, you know, you could go many nodes. You could go down in 100 districts away where someone actually did this.
Once you sold it to one, you've sold it to everybody.
You're right on. And then it's saturation. So vendors will say, you know, this is in 300 schools. Well, that's different than saying we piloted it in 10 schools and we're taking trials of how to improve it or whatever. It's saturation. But you're right. Once you've sold it to one, everybody looks at that as customer perceived value and says, I have to have that. We have to have that in our school. And if the money comes out there through grant funding, they'll put it in customer perceived value. So that I think is going to open the door to a lot of that AI possibility in the classroom. But I mean, if I'm going into teaching next as my profession, you know, we talked essential, non-essential. I believe you have to believe you will be in an environment where everything you do on the clock will be recorded in that setting. And it might not be different, again, in other jobs, right? It might be if you're working, you know, at a grocery store. I mean,
yeah, any number of things could happen here where you're going to be recorded all the time.
Yeah, I think that authentic record or, you know, in the medical field, right? At a hospital or a counselor, right? I mean, that would get really strange, wouldn't it? Or even, you know, discussions with a lawyer. What if something is created in deep? I mean, like, holy smokes. I mean, you can start to think about this, but I think the school stuff is where it's probably most likely to show up first.
So here's the fun one, David, back to your theory about people just buying stuff just because number two pencil. Somebody bought a number two pencil and they had a good salesman that day. And next thing you know, everybody's just number two pencils instead of number ones.
You're serious about that?
No, but it makes sense, doesn't it? I mean, there's no reason number one pencils weren't number one.
Right. Right. Those number one pencils, those things are horrible. No, you're right though. I mean, right. That's a spot on example. And nobody, you know, nobody takes the time to pilot, you know, this stuff. And there's no long-term study. There's, you know, one of the things schools did too is they would relax door codes, or I shouldn't say relax. They would change door codes. So instead of a simple pull-down lever to get out of a door, maybe it would be a keypad plus a lever. So it'd be like two locking devices. But like, you know, that was never tested with a student with a disability, you know, or with 4K kids, right? 4-year-old kids in a 4-year-old community classroom that now the door handle that they've been used to their entire life now has some numbers up on the wall that you have to press first, and then you have to pull the handle down for 2 seconds and then it'll release. And so yeah, nobody knows if these things really work or if, you know, they might work in one scenario. You know, bollards are an example, right? Like bollards seem to make sense more and more in front of some doors, but you know, are you going to bollard across an entire, you know, basically a school because someone could go up on a sidewalk or up on a playground? So, but yeah, I think if you come back to like, you know, show me the evidence that this works, that's a really hard question for people to answer. And that it doesn't have entropy, right? That it doesn't fatigue, that you don't, it maybe it worked really well, staff were trained, but then next year you have 40% of your staff is new and they have been trained, right? So they don't know how to use these systems, or kids come in and they don't know how to use these reporting systems, or you have new parents into the district. So these things also tend to fatigue. There's a safety fatigue that happens. So
here we go. So I got my last question for you. I don't know if I've asked you this one before. This has been around for a while, but I don't think it's been around for you yet. So maybe here we go. What's your favorite breakfast?
My favorite breakfast. I'm going with scrambled eggs and bacon.
Pretty solid, David.
And a green apple to go with that.
So thanks for playing with me earlier. I think we got it figured out now.
Technology's crazy.
All right. Talk to you soon. Maybe.
All right. Thanks for having me on the Mallory Report.
There you go. Oh, yeah. Sorry, I was looking for the outro music. You know, all this new stuff, and I moved it around on my screen. Okay, so here we go. Now we're going to play it.
It's the Mallard Report. Yeah, the Mallard Report.
Hey, I want to thank you for joining us. It's been a good show tonight. I hope you enjoyed it. Take a few moments, subscribe, share, all the fun stuff. You know how to do it. I don't have to tell you. Just be ready for next week. It'll be sooner than you think.
Bruce Martin, host of Pit Pass Indy. Each week, I go behind the scenes of the NTT IndyCar Series and introduce our listeners to the biggest stars of IndyCar, which features the Indianapolis 500 as its cornerstone event. The men and women that compete in IndyCar may be the bravest athletes in all of sport, as danger lurks around every corner. They are able to look danger in the eye without flinching. That is why the NTT IndyCar Series features the best racing on the planet. Join me every week as we talk to the stars of IndyCar, including the legends of the Indianapolis 500, on Pit Pass Indy from Evergreen Podcast.